Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to PodNuts Daily, episode number 473, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Allish. I'm joined today by Anthony Remus from Remus Computer Solutions. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing, man?
I am doing awesome. I am ready to learn about your business because your business is a little bit different than I think what a lot of people talk about in this show. And you actually, you not only put together high-end machines, but you actually sell those to paying customers, correct?
Yeah, believe it or not, I've found a way to have people pay me for this.
And obviously, it's probably something that you absolutely love to do.
It is, and I think that's how most of us get started into this industry. And I'm kind of being stubborn and I want to stick to it because it's what I absolutely love to do.
That is awesome. I love to hear when people are passionate about what they do and they're willing to figure out a way in how to get into the marketplace and actually sell this to their customer base. Let's go ahead and get started. And why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of a background of where you got started, how this all came about, and what you're doing today.
Okay. So I ran through this in my head so many times, Jeff, and I'm gonna try to make it so everybody stays listening on this. I think like most of us, I've always been in a technology as a kid. I was there through the 80s and 90s. You know, I'm 33 now. You know, so I'm not too old, but. As a kid in the 90s, I remember watching the megahertz wars, you know, like, oh my gosh, every week it seemed like, well, 300 megahertz, 400. And there was this progression. And my parents never understood computers. You know, they never got me one. And then maybe somewhere in the 90s, my parents got a computer and I was so happy. I got to play Mech Warrior a little bit.
Classic.
Yeah, and then my dad was frustrated. You know, he's like, "This CRT monitor doesn't look very good." And we took the monitor back for exchange. We got another one. He wasn't happy with it, and I think it was just kind of a little bit of not being comfortable with the computer, where he ended up returning it and kind of went computerless through high school. You know, we had a word processor, which I don't know if many people remember what those were. Because I think our phones have more power than those ever did, you know, obviously.
Right.
Oh. And but through all that time, I was always kind of like watching from the outside, always into computers. And then as my professional career, I got really into cars in high school and kind of changed my course from wanting to go into computers to going into cars. Once I finally had my career going and I had enough money, I finally bought my first computer. Actually, my parents had one like my senior year, but by then it was kind of like I was already into cars. So I was, you know, like I lived it, you know, street racing and everything. So I got my computer and it was a Pentium 4 hyper-threaded, you know, a Dell. It was cool. It was a web browsing machine. And then I'd get bored sometimes after work. And I'm like, I don't want to spend all this. The PlayStation 3 just came out and I had a PlayStation 2. And I'm like, I don't really want to spend $600. I think that's what they were going for at the time. I'm like, I don't want to spend that much on a console. Like that's a lot of money. So I looked up video cards and I'm like, well, I got an AMD X700. You know, which was actually PCIe because AGP or whatever the old, connection was, that was, fortunately my computer had PCIe. And that kind of started the whole upgrading computers. And, you know, so that was about, I was like 03, 04. Built computers for family and friends, but I didn't actually build my first computer, my personal first computer, till 2011.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I went all out. It was an AMD 6-core 1100T processor. That was about the time when Intel was launching their Sandy Bridge, you know, the 2000 series.
Okay. And yep.
So it was just a web browsing machine. It was total overkill. Like, you know, I just wanted to finally build my own because it was, you know, I was further along in my career, making more money. And I kind of got, like, I felt bad. I had this really powerful computer and all it did was, you know, I used Internet Explorer because I actually had a computer powerful enough to run Internet Explorer.
Oh. You know?
So I got into gaming again.
Okay.
And then overclocking, because, you know, you can't overclock OEM computers. They lock all that out. Being a car guy, I loved tuning my, I have a 66 Mustang. I loved tuning the carburetor, tuning the timing. I loved just going through the car, and I applied that. I saw that, like, through overclocking.
Right.
For those that may not know, that's basically you take a factory rated Intel 3 gigahertz processor, and then you run it 3.5, 3.8 gigahertz, 4 gigahertz, except now, you know, everyone's been shooting for 5 gigahertz. And man, that first year, you know, those first 2 years after building my first computer, I think I went through like five processors, not because I was killing them, but because I'd max out that setup, I'd sell the parts and then build a new one. And it really helped jumpstart me through everything I've missed for through the past years. I kind of just had this really like cram session of hardware. Overclocking, I felt, really helped me see the limitations of you know, cooling and, you know, processors performance, because overclocking, you got to benchmark, you got to test your performance. So I think I got a really good crash course on what processors are capable of, you know, the abuse they could take. And then that was a hobby really until 2012. I got married, and wow, I didn't have the free money I used to have, you know, like
that'll stop that a little bit. Yes.
Yeah. So I couldn't do these binge upgrades. I used to upgrade my video card all the time. Like we'd get quarterly bonuses at work, and I'm like, oh, that was pure play money. So, you know, it wasn't a lot. It was a couple $100. So once I got married, it was kind of like, oh, well, my rent just kind of went up a lot. Because, I mean, from renting a room to renting a whole place. I kind of felt this void because I couldn't upgrade like I used to. Mm. And then, you know, I think around it was 2014 is when I thought, like, you know what? I'm just going to throw an ad up on Craigslist. I mean, I'm really good at building computers. I really understand the hardware. If anyone wants me to build a computer, I'll do it. You know, whatever. Like, so I got my first actual customer at the tail end of 2014. He was a retired attorney. And he wanted a computer for his big rig that was his toy hauler. So
okay.
He literally has a Volvo big rig for his, you know, to go out on vacation and haul his stuff. And his thing was he needed 12-volt input. He didn't want AC, you know, to, you know, he didn't want a DC to AC converter.
Right. Okay.
I built that for him and he was so, you know, I guess he also like did engineering at some point in his career. So he was so amazed with his computer I built him. He was like, you gotta do something. Like, people will pay you for this. Like, and I charged him a very fair amount because it was a lot of, I had to go out and see his big rig. I had to see what space we were working with. you know, I made a couple hundred dollars off of it. And he really kind of made me think like, well, I think he's right. I mean, so 2015, I did my paperwork for, I really did my paperwork and kind of like legalized, like made my business an actual business. But there was a lot of back end that was going on at the same time. I was getting frustrated with work, you know, like I was always trained, like you work hard, you know, my parents raised me to be a leader and I wanted to move into management, but I kept seeing the wrong people get promoted. Just because they knew people, the right people, you know, and
yep. Okay.
I was this model employee and I started to kind of like the road kind of crossed where I'm like, and maybe I could start my business as a means to one day leave my day job. You know, my wife and I, we got the news that we were having twins and I'm like, oh, this is going to totally change life, you know? So I kind of wanted to be more, I kind of want to be more than just a mechanic, you know? Not that there's anything wrong with that, because I really enjoyed that. And I think my experience there really prepared me for where I'm heading. And at the same time, I found the Podnuts Network. Like, you guys are instrumental for where I am today, because just hearing the experience of all of you guys talking, you know, on the live show, and then early on, it seemed like you guys really did a lot of how to start a business podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of binge listening while I was at work, just because, you know, my early part of the career, I started with Mercedes-Benz, and then during the economy crash of 07, I switched to forklifts just because it was, you know, stable industry.
Okay.
And it allowed me for, you know, allowed me the time to like, you know, I could listen to podcasts, I could listen to radio, I could do whatever really, because I mean, you're just working on a forklift at your van in someone's parking lot. So I binge listened to Podnuts and really you guys were the only podcast I kind of like felt I was like, I was able to stay interested in.
Okay.
So, you know, fast forward to today. Now I still tell people like I'm still figuring this out.
Hey, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
We're all still figuring it out.
Yeah. And I'm going to outright say I'm only doing about 3 computers a month, but I mentioned, you know, we got the news, our boys, we're going to have twins. In California, childcare is very expensive. So it eventually came to the point where I think I got to leave my day job and watch the boys. And this is at least allowing for some supplemental income to help us get through this, this time, really. It's by no means replacing the income I had, but when we factor in how much we're saving from childcare, this has kind of really been like the grease that has helped this happen.
And now when you say 3 computers, though, let's preface this. These are 3 high-end computers. These are not 3 OEM, HP, no. Dell workstations. These are something you're building by hand, doing the wiring, all this kind of great stuff on the inside, and you're making Absolutely. It for CAD, et cetera, right?
Absolutely. So when I first started my... All right, so... I made pretty good money for being a mechanic, and I felt if I could make X amount of money as a knuckle dragging forklift mechanic, you know, that was the joke. I mean, all of us, if you're a good mechanic, a good technician, I called myself a technician because I felt like I know how to read wiring diagrams. I know how to use a voltmeter. I'm a technician. So,
right.
If you're a technician, whether you're fixing cars or computers, that there's nothing to joke about. I just, being in the industry for so long, it's a joke to me. Like, you know, it's just fun for us all to kind of like, you know, we don't have to be so serious all the time.
Right.
But so I felt if I was making X amount of dollars fixing forklifts, I should be able to charge X amount of dollars for building computers and then a little extra because the business needs, you know, the business has expenses too, you know?
Yep.
And, and I'm very transparent with my customers, and I'll share with you guys because I mean it's public knowledge. If I do a computer that's, you know, essentially a high performance office computer, it's $280 my labor. And if it's something with a video card, you know, is essentially 320 and up.
Okay.
And, you know, I got to justify why I'm charging that much. So I build a lot of value into it. So you could imagine if someone's going to pay me that much, they're not just going to have an i3. They want a high-end system.
Right.
So, yeah, everything, you know, most computers are starting at 1500, but I mean, I would say if I did the average computer I built about $2,500. And I know Brad mentioned this one not too long ago. I did a dual Xeon one that was like $300 shy of $10,000. So
right.
I kind of cover the spectrum. So yeah, they're all high-end systems.
Now, Brad has said that the computers he's gotten from you for his customers, basically, the wiring inside is primo, and everything is just tight and right. And he said you do a phenomenal job. And so he was passing out your information to other people, and hopefully people that maybe don't want to do this themselves, because I'll be honest with you, I'm jealous, because if I could have figured out a way, and I probably still could, to build high-end computers to sell to customers, I only do it every once in a while. And again, they are high-end machines. I mean, minimum, most of the time, the ones I've built are right around $2,000, just because somebody needs it for a specific purpose. And the reality is, I've gone back and forth in my business where I've basically said, depending on what you're doing, hey, maybe you only need a Core i3 gateway computer or Dell, HP, whatever from Best Buy, because you're just surfing the web and checking email. But there's a lot of people out there that are using underpowered machines. They might be doing audio editing, video editing, and they're getting by with just the bare minimums, and they're wondering why they're burning their PCs up, because they don't have the proper equipment for doing the job. And that's where you come in, because you're building the proper equipment that these people need in order to do their job with less frustration.
Yeah, I agree. When I first started to kind of determine what my entry-level computer was going to be, I thought I needed a system under $1,000 to like have people be interested. You know, and I... you know, I guess to not get too off track, but, you know, right now, currently, all of my advertising is on Craigslist. I've tried Google AdWords, but currently it's all on Craigslist. Okay. And on Craigslist, I thought I needed something under $1,000. Otherwise, no one's going to care. Who's going to trust someone off Craigslist to buy a $5,000 computer? But no one ever contacted me for that system. I always got contacted for the $2,000, the $3,000, the $4,000 computer.
Nice.
And I kind of learned, I think the person that's looking for a Dell or an HP, they're not going to go to Craigslist. They're going to go to Best Buy.
Right.
And which was great news for me, because I didn't really want to build those anyways. Because I mean, I can't compete with Dell, you know, like, so it made me uncomfortable really. Because I'm like, man, what Dell could sell a computer for, that's like the parts. It doesn't even include my labor.
Right.
So yeah, what I do when I go through a computer, I have high standards. You know, like there's nothing wrong with like a bronze power supply, but I kind of stick to gold rated power supplies.
Okay.
And, you know, I set these certain standards for my customers so that, you know, they're spending a lot. So I want them to receive something quality. And, I do cable management, and through my Instagram page, I've actually, I couldn't have, this is like one of those things where I'm going to quote, like it was lucky, but, I'll give you my definition of luck later, but, through my cable management, NZXT reached out to me, their community manager, they posted two previous computers I did on their like Instagram page. And then they later this year came to me and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in being a contracted builder for us? And because I took the time in cable managing and making them look great, because they're not cheap computers, I kind of like, I'm a contracted builder for NZXT. Like, I've done one project with them. We're kind of talking about another one. And it kind of shows, like, if you work hard and you take pride in your work, you know, things happen.
Absolutely. Now, you said you have an Instagram page?
Yes.
Okay, definitely send me a link for that, and we'll add it in the show notes.
Perfect. It is just RemusCS, but I'll send you the link.
Okay.
And I do want to get on my definition of luck. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right, but it's a Roman philosopher named Seneca. And I saw it once, and it stuck with me. And it says, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. So...
Nice.
Yeah, it was lucky NZXT saw my computer, but if I wasn't working hard and, you know, doing my thing, hashtagging my computers with their hashtag, I mean, you know, it's like, if I didn't do a few things, that deal would have never happened.
Right, exactly.
So,
very
but,
cool.
Yeah.
Now, I'm excited. Yeah, I'm excited to, now, I'm looking at your webpage right now. The computers you have up there, are those some of the ones you've built?
Yeah. Every computer I post, whether it's my Instagram page or my webpage, is an actual customer computer. And I sign every computer too. So some of my images aren't watermarked because I'm like, well, my signature's on it. So if anyone wants to steal the image, I mean, my signature's on it.
Gotcha.
Literally. But I've had customers tell me, like, hey, you know what? I want to tell you I went with you because your photography is so professional, or, you know, the cable management's, you know, excellent. And they ask me, is this literally what I'm going to receive? Like, I'm like, yeah, that's literally a customer computer. That's what you're going to get.
So you found a way to basically fill that need in your life to build high-end machines because you wanted high-end machines. And you're like, hey, I got married, I had some kids, and all of a sudden now I can't spend the money that I like to, but you actually can through your customers, which is really kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. And while I have pricing structures in place, like, that's kind of, I don't like to discount because I don't think it's fair for the next guy. Like Chris on the show, I think I hear his voice sometimes when I think about discounting something.
And, don't do it.
Yeah. And you know what? The one time I actually did, I got burned for it. Like, I'm like, I could have charged this guy double. And he's here like pretending he's like, you know, oh, this, you know, I've saved up for a year. And I'm like, I call and he has a secretary and he owns this attorney underwriting company. And I'm like, oh, like I could have totally charged you my full price and you wouldn't have cared. He just likes to negotiate. He's a business owner.
Sure.
And you know, he just likes the art of negotiating. But yeah, so I'm a little, well, I forgot what my train of thought was going to be with that, but.
Well, I wanted to say something about your, you know, going back to your pricing. Okay. Mm-hmm. I just, the pricing that you talked about, I can tell you right now, in my mind, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you're still on the cheap side.
I agree with you. My wife especially agrees with you because she knows how much time I spend, but I feel like I need to build the brand first before
sure.
I could charge a little more. But I base it off of like a $45 an hour rate.
Yeah, you need to double that.
I think you're right. like that dual Xeon computer, the one I told you, you know, with California tax and everything, it was almost 10,000. Well, if he would have gone to like an actual builder, like, you know, like there's a company called Box and they spell it with like two X's, I believe.
Okay.
Where they just do workstations. Like, I included the new Titan X in his system. their system didn't even have the new Titan X, the Pascal version. They had the older one. And we were like at 11.5, and that didn't include tax or shipping.
Wow. Okay.
And I charged more than my normal rate for that computer. I still made a lot more than my normal rate, and I was still able to save my customers a substantial amount.
Right.
So, I think once I go through my process a little bit, I think my customers can see that they're getting their money's worth, you know?
Absolutely. I'm like I said, I'm just looking at the pictures and I'm like, it literally salivating over here because I'm like, those are nice machines.
Thanks. And Brad gets to play with a lot of those.
I'm jealous of a lot of stuff he does too. You guys out in California, man, you make me sick. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that's one area where I think like I'm fortunate because I'm in Huntington Beach and I'm like, I got Newport Beach down the street. Los Angeles isn't far. It seems like there's a lot of architects in Costa Mesa area, Newport. So I'm like, I'm in a good area. And I'm hoping to get more customers like that architect because he's like the dream customer. But, you can't stay, you can't be their go-to guy if you don't deliver service either.
Right. And going back to that too, just so everybody is clear on this, I believe there are high-end customers everywhere that you live in the United States of America. So I think you can find, you just have to find where they're at, what they're doing. I know I live in Michigan and a lot of times people will go, oh, Michigan's failing this and that. And it's like, and I can tell you just from going around town myself and seeing the businesses and different things that are involved, there's a lot of people with a lot of money and you just have to, like what you've done, you've shown a superior product to a lot of stuff that they can buy out there, whether at a Best Buy or even a boutique builder. I mean, it's stuff every once in a while I get boutique stuff that I'm fixing and I just go, I know what they paid for the machine and I look at it and I go, oh my gosh, you just got ripped off.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I completely agree with you, Jeff, because I see it like, why do I need, I'm a car guy. So I'm like, there's Ferrari guys and there's Honda guys, you know, not to discriminate on the Honda guys, but, someone could upgrade their Honda to be as fast as a Ferrari, but the Ferrari guy doesn't want the Honda, even if it's faster than his, Ferrari that, on the track. It's two different types of buyers.
Right.
And I'm kind of learning, like, I get to pick my customer by how much I charge and the quality I deliver. So I don't want to make myself too cheap. But, I also, because I don't have the brand completely built yet, I don't want to charge what like the big names are charging, even though I think my quality, sometimes is a lot better than what they're getting from some of these bigger names.
Oh, from what I've heard, it's usually all the time, but that's a different story. It's just something for you to bear in mind for yourself, though, that you are doing a good service, you're charging a decent rate, but just know that deep down inside, as you grow your business and you move ahead, yes, you want to be able to get your way in the market, but you're also going to need to know that you are worth more than what you're charging right now. And so if you can move that up over time, that'll help you in the long run to where you can continue to do the things that you like to do, building high-end machines.
Yeah, and to say something to that, I've had a customer tip me $100. And, some people will think, $300? I've been told by, trolls online, you're ripping people off at $300. And I don't really need to argue with those people because I don't think they realize, like, the cost of doing business. But when I get a $100 tip, that kind of tells me, oh, maybe I need to charge more. One of the last computers I did, it was a woman who was, it was a streaming computer. She wanted to do game streaming. She was shopping around and she called me back after we spoke and she's like, you're definitely the most professional sounding and the other guy wanted to charge $200, which seemed kind of cheap. And I thought to myself, I'm like, wow, I'm totally kind of, that caught me off guard. I didn't expect to hear that from a customer. And she tipped me at the end, like, well, since I'm not revealing this person's name or anything, like I got over $50 tip.
Nice.
Which I wasn't expecting. And I'm like, that tells me these people saw what they received and it was worth more than what they paid. So they tipped me.
Right.
Because why else would you tip somebody that much, right? I mean.
Well, when you're getting tips or you get the, when people go, that's it, then you kind of know that you're not charging enough.
Yeah. And I know this has been a discussion on the show before. It's like, what do you charge? And if you go on Craigslist or if you go to, like, you know, I got a Micro Center nearby. I got Fry's nearby. They both offer computer building services for $100. Or it's like $100, $120. And if you go on Craigslist, you'll find people that are doing it for like $40 or even. And so I don't try to really compete with them because I try to sell to my customers. It's a service.
Right.
You know, I just, I have a tentative agreement with a customer right now. And he literally asked me, like, all right, everybody, it's a father. He wants a computer for his son for Christmas. He told me flat out, like, I don't know a thing about computers. All of these specs don't mean anything to me. Everybody says they have the best computer, but what makes yours better than your competition? And I was like, wow, this feels like this is like one of those questions I always wait for, you know? And I tell him flat out, I'm like, you're absolutely right. You could get a computer built for me or for someone else, and we all use the same parts. But what you pay for when you go through me, you pay for service. You know, you're getting a warranty from me. You know, I'm local. Like, if you have any questions, issues, you could call me, you could email me, you could text me. I told them a long list of things I also provide with the computers I do. Like I mentioned, I'm trying to build value in my systems. I bought a little, you know, thermal printer, and I'm now doing QR codes because I've had a few customers call me like, hey, what were the specs on my system again? So now I have a QR code on my computer. So if they're curious what their specs are, you know, they could still email me. I don't mind answering, but, you know, they could use a little app with their smartphone and they could figure out what their specs are.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, my invoices have evolved over time where now I'm including every serial number on the actual invoice. So if there's ever a question or an issue, I don't need to tear the computer apart to get that serial number. I could start the RMA process before the computer is even here if it's clear what the problem is.
Nice. That is a great idea.
Yeah. And then, well, I don't know if you want to, I don't want to like kind of go off on a different road, Jeff.
Hey, you go wherever you want to go. I'm just here for the ride.
All right, cool. So when I build a computer, you know, like I speak to the customer, I figure out what they want to do with it. But then also through the process of building it, I'm stress testing, I'm benchmarking. Sometimes if they request overclocking, I do charge extra for that, but I'll overclock. And the invoices also include the temperatures I got. I'll include my ambient air temperature because that matters. And like if I was in 74 degree weather and they're at 84 degrees in their apartment or home, oh, you know, I want them to know, like, here, this is the temperature of my room. You know, here's your CPU load temperatures. Here's how many watts your computer was consuming. I use a kilowatt meter, so we could kind of have an estimate of, you know, you still got to factor in the efficiency of the power supply, but I just give the reading off of the kilowatt meter, and I give them this information so that if in a year from now we wonder, like, is it really running hotter than it was a year ago, or is it just because the weather's warm, or, you know, I have this baseline that they have, and I have it saved on my Google Drive, but it's like sharing the information so they see, like, I'm not just building it and, like, you know, here's your computer, see you later.
Right.
you know?
Well, and that's the thing nowadays. I tell a lot of people that service is king. And the problem is there's not a whole lot of actual service left here anymore. Most people are just turn and burn. Hey, here's your stuff. Bye. See you later. If it breaks, let me know and I'll sell you another one. Versus actually having that customer care where you do all these extra things and you're smart because not only are you letting the customer know what their baseline is, you're also able to have that information at hand if, in fact, you need to do things with warranties and figure out what their problems are. So in the long run, you're saving yourself time. And let's face it, most of us are very, very lazy on our paperwork. I still find it very hard to, I just want to tear into a computer instead of taking it and inputting the information into my ticketing system and making sure that I make notations of everything I've done, passwords, all that kind of stuff, so that I can go back to it quickly versus if I don't put that information in there, I've got to go and ask them questions, and that takes time, back and forth emails, back and forth phone calls. And my time's valuable, so I just need to take a little bit of time up front to save me a lot of time in the future.
Yeah, and that was an issue I was having too. It's like, you know, because of, you know, my situation, I'm often building computers like really late. Like I'll start at like 10 o'clock at night. Just because, I mean, I am watching my kids and I'm actually finding like I have less time watching the kids than I did when I was working, it seemed. But so I start late at night, you know, I might go from 10 to 2 or 3 in the morning and I'd kind of like, I'll do my serial numbers, I'll do all my paperwork, you know, then, you know, after I get some sleep, you know. But then that turns into like, oh man, the computer, the customer is coming in a few hours. I got to get this thing done now. So what I do now is when I quote somebody, I used to just kind of like write the parts in an email, you know. Now I'm actually doing the invoice I would be giving them as a receipt. I use that as my quote. So now the quotes, my invoice is already written now. And all I got to do is just add the serial numbers. I don't need to, you know, type out all the parts all over again. And the way I found I get my serial numbers quickly and efficiently, because, man, you know what serial numbers look like.
If you can see them.
Yeah, well, this is the best part for everybody. I use a QR reading app, which is like also, they all kind of read barcodes too.
A good tip.
So every part you buy, the barcodes on them are the serial number. So what I do on my phone, I scan the barcode, I get the serial number, and I paste it into an email draft. I use Android, so I paste it into a Gmail email that's a draft. I get the next part, and it's a quick process. I could do every part in a build, I don't know, maybe five minutes, definitely less than 10 minutes. And since it's saved as a draft, it's already at my desktop, and I just copy and paste that into Excel, which is how I do my invoices.
That is genius.
Yeah, because, dude, Jeff, it would probably take me, honestly, at least 30 minutes doing it with pen and paper and then typing it, like, you know, and then double-checking to make sure I didn't, like, do a typo.
Right. So, I inverted two numbers, and, oh, now that number's... No, that's genius. That is really good. Okay,
cool. Yeah. I could go a little further into that, but I don't know if you have any questions.
No, continue on with your process. So you get all this information gathered for your customer to make sure that you've got everything on task. And obviously you've learned how to save yourself time in doing these tasks that you know you need to do versus, I'm sure back in the day, you probably started off with manual labor, so to speak, and figured out, oh man, this is adding so much more time and I've got to become more efficient so that I get that good hourly rate instead of cutting into my hourly rate and making it less.
Yeah, I felt like I could either charge more money or I could get faster. And at the end of the day, I still make more, because if I do the same job faster, you know, now I could do more work in less time.
Right.
And I think eventually the charging more will be the next step. But since I do work from home, so it's like, I don't want to like scare someone off with like, all right, well, your computer's gonna be $500. And unless I have the foundation already in place to justify it.
Right.
So the latest thing I started to do is live stream my builds. I use Twitch for the moment, twitch.tv. The last two computers I built, I did a live stream on. I get permission from the customer. Well, the first one I didn't reveal any customer information, and it was a generic office build, but I'm like, you know, I better get permission. I got permission from the second customer, and I figure if I'm going to be building it, I mean, I'm already building it. I have two cameras, so there's two angles, and I'm just building it and I'm talking about what I'm doing. So if the customer wonders, like, I wonder what went into my computer, there's an archive that I put on YouTube. So they could see, like, oh, I wonder how he did this. Well, let me see, you know?
Very cool.
And I answer questions that might show up in chat, you know? If anything, you know, people think like, oh, it's going to take longer, but I think it keeps me more on track, because I know there's a live audience watching, and I can't like sit down for 5 minutes and have a snack, you know?
So you go from the beginning to the end doing, so you're not just doing a video, you're actually live streaming the build of that computer.
Yeah. So, you know, I did a gaming build, and that was, I think, a 4.5 hour stream. And wow. I did everything, Jeff, like from I scanned the barcodes on camera. Obviously, they can't see because, you know, it's low resolution, you know, it's webcams. It's not like they could enlarge the footage. But, you know, they're 1080p, the Logitech C922 webcams. Yep. So it's not bad. I just described my process. So anyone else that wants to do this, they know what I'm doing. Or if the customer is curious, like, I kind of have your mentality, whereas like, I think there's plenty of business for everybody. You just got to find it, really.
That's right.
But yeah, I do everything. I did the serial numbers. I built it on the bench, and then I, you know, moved the hardware into the computer case. I got into the BIOS. I installed Windows, and that's where I ended the stream, because the benchmarking and everything is, that's kind of, you know, it's running benchmarks is really what are you going to do, you know?
Right. Yeah. Unless you're running like a, you know, 3D Mark or something like that.
Yeah. I do run 3D Mark on some computers. I'm open to talk about, I guess, the programs I use too.
Yeah. Let's do that. What do you use to bench test your computers?
This is kind of like evolving a little bit, but so I started to build computers early on an actual like bench rather than the case, because the first few months I had two bad motherboards, and
Man,
when you look at my cable management, like everything's really zip tight in place, and it you know, it was no big deal. I was able to swap the boards out without really cutting many zip ties, but I was like, dude, this was a time killer, because I had to troubleshoot it inside the computer. And so I kind of adopted, like, I'm just going to build on the bench. And I benchmark it before it goes in the system. And what I run is I'll do Cinebench.
Okay.
Which is a CPU benchmark. I run the video card portion too, even though it doesn't really stress video cards like a graphics, like a 3D Mark or like a Unigine benchmark, but I'll run Cinebench on my test bench. If the CPU looks good, the scores look good, then I build inside the computer. And then once everything's completely assembled, then I run all my benchmarks. I kind of use Cinebench as like the preliminary, like let's make sure things look okay. And then I run Cinebench again to make sure the scores haven't changed. I run Asus RealBench. That's like a full system benchmark. It tests like your productivity, you know, single threaded. It does a few little tests. And then if it's a gaming build, I'll run Unigine Valley, which really is, it's a game engine. So that'll test the video card thoroughly. And then I do Crystal Disk Mark just to make sure like the SSD speeds are on point. And then I'm kind of unsure if I'm going to phase this one out or not, but I run Passmark 8. There's a newer version, I think version 9, but I don't like that one as much. So I run Passmark 8, and that kind of does another system test, except that one will actually benchmark memory speeds, and it does the hard drive also. And because of these benchmarks and stress tests, oh, and also too, after all of that, I'll run like a, depending on the type of computer it is, I'll run either a 30-minute stress test, or if it's like a workstation, you know, even if there's no overclocking, sometimes I'll run 1 or 2 hours, depending on the type of workload the customer is going to have.
Okay.
But because of this, I've been able to catch things before it's gone to my customer. Like one in particular, I had an MSI motherboard that was dead on arrival. In Windows, it seemed to perform fine. And like, you know, because I'm installing updates and you know, they get, my customers get a fully updated Windows. They don't, unless an update came the day they took it home, it's going to be ready to go. So during doing everything like drivers and everything, it was running just fine. But the Cinebench score was lower than a laptop i5, and this was an i7. It was, at the time, it was a 4790K i7, so the one that goes up to 4.4 gigahertz.
Okay.
And midway through Cinebench, it would just go down to like 900 megahertz.
Ooh.
Yeah, and that explained why the scores were so low.
Okay.
There was no overheating. And I went through, you know, I checked the BIOS, power states. I did a lot of thorough troubleshooting before I realized that's just a bad motherboard. And sure enough, that's what it was. But if I didn't do these benchmarks and the stress testing, and it looked like it was running fine. I could have turned this over to a customer and they would have brought it right back saying it's performing horribly.
Right. Okay.
And also, too, while I'm doing the benchmarks and everything, I use MSI Afterburner to watch temperatures of the CPU and GPU. So the newer versions, I used to use two programs, but I'd say maybe about 6 months to a year ago, they started including CPU usage. So I just kind of just use that to monitor temperatures and, you know, of the CPU and GPU during all the stress testing and benchmarking.
Okay. Now, do you have a nominal temperature that you try to stay at on your builds?
Yeah. Now, a lot of this depends on like the cooling, because, you know, is this a water cooled system or is this air cooled? But man, any Intel CPU will stay fine with the normal cooler. So if it's a stock, whether it's a 8-core, 12-core, or a 4-core, I want to make sure at least stock, it's no higher than 70 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
Because the cooling I use, this isn't like, you know, sometimes I do use the stock Intel because I'll get business owners. They just want a fast desktop. They don't, you know, they've had refurbs or whatnot, and they just kind of want to, they just want something fast. So, you know, they're, while I stress test the i7 6700, or a 6700K on a 212 Evo, which is a $30 cooler, those do not overheat. So many people will do an all-in-one water cooler with no intention to overclock, and you really don't need it. A 212 Evo will cool. I've even used it on 6-core processors. I've used actually something just a little better than the 212 Evo on the Intel Xeon 12-core, it's the 2687W V4. It's like a base clock of 3 gigahertz on 12 cores, and those single-tower coolers will do just fine. But I look for 70 degrees Celsius and less, you know, and they're usually in the 50s.
Okay.
If it's in the 60s, well, what temperature is my room? Is it 90 degrees? Is it a summer, you know, is it like a 90 degree summer day or, you know, but if it's overclocked, technically, you know, 85 degrees Celsius is the max. I kind of draw the line at 80 degrees Celsius, but ideally I want to stay in the 60s. And 70s, I consider like my ears are kind of like my spidey sense is going off in the 70s.
Okay.
Just because I don't ever want my customers to worry about temperatures. So usually I shoot for 60s on an overclock system so that if they have a 90 degree day, and you know, if I was doing my stress testing in 75 degree weather, I want it to be good in 90 degree weather as well.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's kind of what I do for temperatures.
Now, if somebody was just testing out maybe their own machine, what couple programs would you use to not only bench test it that would be easy for everybody to use and also check the temperatures at the same time?
So, and this is part of my troubleshooting too. Like if I'm getting weird power downs or just any weird issue, I always use Cinebench for my CPU, just because it's going to use every thread, every core. It renders an image basically. It doesn't care if it's AMD or Intel. It's going to use every resource it has to render this image. So that will give me a quick look into what the CPU is doing.
Okay.
So someone, if they're curious, and it's very kind of standardized, you could kind of like Google. Most reviewers, like if you have, let's say, an i7-6700K, and you Google like 6700K review, most reviewers use Cinebench. So you could kind of tell, like, if you're a repair tech, I wonder if this processor is running like it should. You could Google that processor and chances are you'll find results for that benchmark.
Okay. Gotcha. So Cinebench would be for basically that tests the CPU then.
Yeah, there is a GPU portion, but you know, it's not DirectX and it kind of doesn't really stress the video card like a DirectX benchmark would. So for video cards, I use Unigen Valley. That's kind of quicker than their Unigen Heaven benchmark. So if I'm kind of suspecting the video card is bad and it's intermittent, I might actually go for Unigen Heaven because it's a more stressful benchmark and it's longer. And I could, you know, if the video card's bad, usually three loops of Heaven will reveal that, you know, whether it's overheating or the system shuts down. And if I really wanted to murder the system because I think the power supply might be the cause, I might do Cinebench and Valley at the same time.
Okay.
That's kind of been ways I kind of try to find if the power supply is bad. You know, because the intermittent ones, it doesn't matter if you have a power supply tester. It's going to test good without a load. So I try to really stress the system so that the consumption is up and we'll see if the power supply can fail under those conditions.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then while I'm monitoring all that, I use the MSI Afterburner program.
And that'll give you the temperatures.
Yeah, and I could see also, so like on a 4-core processor, I could see the use of every core, kind of like you can in Task Manager. In Windows 10, the Task Manager is kind of in the Performance tab. You could kind of see a little bit of that, but with MSI Afterburner, you could actually log that to a file. And if you had a customer that was reporting like, you know, I get these random power downs, like it shuts off on its own or whatever. You could have MSI Afterburner start when the computer turns on, log its data to a file, and maybe look for weird issues right before the computer shut down? Like, was there a high spike in CPU usage or, you know, just weird stuff?
Okay.
But yeah, that's kind of my, some of the software tools I use.
Now,
troubleshooting hardware.
What's your rule of thumb as far as power supplies? Do you tend to go a little bit overboard to give a little more headroom, or do you kind of keep it close to what you're building?
This is like the great debate among hardware enthusiasts. You'll have the crowd that almost like scoffs at you, like, oh my gosh, that system only uses 300 watts. Why do you have a 600 watt power supply? But I tend to kind of, I look for a balance. It completely depends on the computer. But if it's like an office computer, because I've done a few i7, I've even done 6700K, like the overclocked, you know, the overclockable i7. I've done some of those on office computers because that's what the customer wants. Right. So I'm not going to put a 400 watt power supply that's probably bronze rated. It could be perfectly fine, but I'll go for like a 550 watt gold rated one. You know, if they wanted that level of quality, there's, like I said, there's nothing wrong. It's a fully functional power supply. But one of the things I kind of go for is I like using modular power supplies, because if there is a failure, I could get that replaced quickly without rewiring the whole system.
Okay.
My thing is I want them to be running as much, you know, I want their uptime to be as high as possible. I don't want to have to spend a whole day rewiring a computer because they wanted to save $5 or $10 and not get a modular power supply. Because that's really what it comes down to. They're getting cheap enough nowadays where it might be $20 more.
Right.
Now, if that means I could slap a power supply in 15 minutes and it's done versus maybe spending 2 hours, I think, you know, the money they make off of that system is going to justify that small investment.
Now, I could be wrong here, but my rule of thumb has always been if you tend to use a bigger power supply than what you actually need, you'll actually, over time, you will use less electricity because you have, you're not maxing this thing out where it's running things all the time, whether it's running the video card, the hard drives, so on and so forth. You've got a little bit of headroom in there where you can, it's going to be a constant state of electricity instead of this humongous fluctuation where it hits the top and then it's just stressing all the time. So I tend to try to put bigger than what I actually need. And really the prices between the power supplies, they're really not that much, even on the higher end stuff.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Power supplies are most efficient at their 50 to 60%. Load rating. So right. if you look at their efficiency chart, they're, I don't know what it is with the electrical engineering aspect, but in the 50 to 60% usage, they're most efficient.
Right.
And another aspect of why I might go higher on wattage than really is necessary is because most power supplies nowadays have variable speed fans. And one aspect I like are very quiet computers.
Yes.
If their system's using 400 watts at full load, and if we use like a 750 watt, that fan may never, ever turn on.
Right.
You know, and things are getting a lot more efficient nowadays. So you could technically run a two 1080s, GTX 1080 video cards off of a 750 watt. But if that was the case, then I would also go up to like 1,000 watt. Just because even though the system might consume only 600 watts, I want it to be efficient, like you said. I want it to be quiet. And I want it gold rated just because, you know, you figure if it's a more efficient power supply, it's better quality components. And I shoot for modular just so if it does fail, I could throw a new one in very quickly. Yeah, I've done some systems with 4 video cards. Imagine redoing the wiring on that if it wasn't modular.
Oh.
So that's my point, you know, and I warranty my systems too. So it's like, if it happens in the first year, man, that's labor I'm eating. If it happens after the first year, that's more I got to charge on. So,
you know, speaking of efficiency, I was just sitting here thinking, and I didn't even realize this. The particular video card I bought, it was a 980 GTX. Probably 6 months ago, maybe almost a year ago. When I put it in my system and I was building everything, my son was like going, he goes, hey, your fans aren't moving. And I'm looking at it and I go, yeah, you're right. Matter of fact, while we're recording this podcast right now, my fans on my video card are not moving, not one inch. They just sit there. And I'm like going, it's amazing nowadays, the technology they put in these things. It's running at optimal temperature. It's not running a game, a video. It doesn't need to run at a high RPM. So I'm just amazed with the technology that I didn't even realize what I was putting into my own machine.
I completely agree with you. And I did an audio computer for a composer, and you know, like I used, I think it was the tail end of the 700 series, but I used a 950 video card, GTX 950, just for that passive feature. In his recording environment, he wants, you know, he's doing digital, like digital audio, so he's not like physically recording with a mic, but he doesn't want anything, causing a distraction from his creative space, is what he called it.
Right.
So I got the 900 series video card, so the fan wasn't spinning, because he's not doing video graphics load. He just needed two monitors,
right?
And it was an X99 system, so we needed a video card. And we got the beefy power supply, so the fan never turned on, and we overclocked his CPU, but I went air cooled. And I did one of those twin tower, like kind of similar to the Noctua D15, but I used the Fantex version. I went that route instead of like water, because sometimes you could hear the water pumps running.
Wow. Okay.
These air cooled, you know, twin tower process, you know, CPU coolers actually do pretty good.
Right.
So, you know, that 5820K was at 4.5 gigahertz. And I wasn't breaking 75 degrees Celsius. His office was climate controlled to 74 degrees Fahrenheit, and I was testing in almost 80 degree weather. So I knew when it was in its environment, he was going to be golden.
Now, let me ask you another question. I know this is another debate, but when you're looking at the overclocking computers nowadays, in the real world, whether it's game playing, video editing is probably a little bit different, but like game playing, doing things online, all that kind of stuff, is there actually a reason anymore for most people to overclock other than just bragging rights?
It's mixed, because like sometimes I'm overclocking and I do my benchmarks. When I overclock a system, I fully benchmark its stock, and I fully benchmark it and stress test it overclocked. And many times you could get 20% improvement in processing power by overclocking. Now, did they need that? Well, if they didn't need that 20%, then why'd they go i7? They should have gone i5. So if they spent more for an i7, they wanted more performance. And if they're already at the top of the line CPU and they want more performance, well, we could get 20% more out of it if we overclock.
I'm just wondering, and I understand from the benchmark standpoint that you're going to get more percentage out of it, but I look at, because I've gone back and forth where I still would overclock my system, but I basically have a 6-core processor. It's a core i7 that is 3.5, but when it ramps down the amount of cores it actually needs to use, depending on the program that it's running, it will ramp those up and it'll go up to 4 gigahertz, which there's just nothing that slows my machine down. So I go back and forth. I go, am I gaining any real world benefit out of actually overclocking the machines?
This is the funny part. Like I say, oh, well, it's a 20% improvement. What does that really translate to into the real world? Video editing, it might only shave off 5 minutes. Does that 5 minutes mean anything? Probably not. But if it's an office and they have 10 employees and they're all saving, you know, let's say like 20 minutes a day, you calculate that through a year, that's a way for the business owner to get more efficiency without hiring another person, maybe, or without buying a rendering, it's kind of like a way to be more efficient. Like I improve my process by getting faster, or I could charge more. That's kind of what overclocking does.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, you know, it's like, does that 5 minutes matter to you? If I were to make an argument for it, I would say bad software. Like, I don't understand how today we still have software that doesn't utilize more than two cores or four right. cores. And Adobe going backwards and actually being more inefficient with more cores on like Illustrator and such. This doesn't make sense to me, but if your software only uses four cores and you can't throw cores at the problem, well, you could overclock, you know, like, but with overclocking, like, I hear like this Spider-Man quote, like, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, you know, like with overclocking comes great responsibility and some liability, because you're telling the customer, like, I'm going to do this, it's going to work, and it's not going to break down in 3 months.
Right.
So I heavily stress test the system. And for a normal person that doesn't want to think about it, whatever it passes my stress test at, I lower it by 100 megahertz.
Okay.
So that way it's super reliable. You know, one of my personal computers, it's about 5 years old now. It's an i7 2700K processor. It's been at 4.8 gigahertz since the day I got it. And
wow.
You know, so if you think about it, you know, like that, I mean, it's now a backup system, but it completely lasted its life with me. Like now it's serving as a backup computer and it hasn't blown up or, you know, degraded to the point. Video cards degrade faster than processors.
Oh yeah.
CPUs,
I rarely see a bad CPU ever.
Yeah. There was a moment where I got really heavy into video card overclocking and I actually volt modded one of my GTX 770s. And I fed 1.5 volts to that little guy. It's still alive. It's in that system. But so when it was new stock, it used to run at like 1375 megahertz, which was like a golden sample for overclocking. That was really high. Nowadays, today, I could only do about 1200 megahertz on it.
Okay.
And and maybe about 3 years, it lost about 100 megahertz. Under the heavy voltage, I was doing 1.5 gigahertz, which was a lot, but you could see in like the 3 years that actually degraded, whereas the CPU has been, it's been stable for the 4 or 5 years I had that one.
Okay. Now, overclocking. Software or BIOS?
BIOS all day, every day.
Okay. And how do you, so there's so many different settings that are in the BIOSes nowadays. BIOSes, whatever they want to call them. How do you know, and where do you get your information so that you know what you're doing when you're overclocking? Because there's the RAM and there's, you know, this frequency and there's that frequency. And it seems like it can be very overwhelming and confusing.
Yeah, this is, there's like, you know, you could go for the Banzai overclock, but since I'm building them for people, I try to stay conservative. And honestly, the last few years, overclocking has been kind of boring. It's like, oh, you just set your voltage and multiply and you're done. When I got into it with AMD, man, now you could overclock with what used to be the front side bus. You know, they call the base clock. You could do it that way too. But I mean, at the end of the day, if someone's paying me to overclock a system, I leave the base clock alone. I do multiplier and voltage, but I absolutely never use the preset, because you, I mean, I've had people use the preset and, you know, they ask me, hey, you know what? Like, I've had actually people call me like, hey, do you work on computers? You know, this or that. And a lot of times those preset overclocks are not stable, or there are, but they're using a really high voltage. So now your cooling can't keep it cool. Yeah, you got 4.6 gigahertz, but you got to upgrade your cooling because it's a sloppy overclock, because they need it to be stable for a majority of people. So the way I overclock, I keep the CPU simple. I do not overclock the RAM beyond what it's rated. So if someone wants 3000 megahertz RAM, I buy 3000 megahertz RAM and I charge them to overclock the system, because that megahertz on the memory, chances are, isn't going to handle the 100 megahertz base clock. I'm going to have to mess with the base clock and the multiplier. So it's like a full system overclock. It's not just, oh, it has an XMP profile. Not that simple.
Yeah, I've never been real happy with the whole XMP profiles that they've come out with over the last few years.
No, and honestly, I'd rather have CPU frequency over memory frequency, because, man, memory is so much harder to test. Yeah, you could run memtest overnight, but that's overnight just to test something. Like, what are we going to do when it's been in the wild for 6 months and it's overclocked? You know, I'd rather, like, with current generation Intel, I tell people, like, really 2400 megahertz is, if you want an easy experience, don't go above 2400 megahertz. The Intel CPU at 100 megahertz base clock will be fine all day with that. But when you start getting into 2666, 3000, 3200 megahertz RAM, it really completely changes things. Where now you're basically handling a CPU overclock so you could run that memory. So now, if it's unstable, which was it? Was it the RAM or was it the CPU?
Right. Yeah. And so you're having to double troubleshoot the whole problem.
Yeah. That stuff is really, like, if someone's that serious about it, that's the kind of thing you have to do with your free time. Like, because it's going to take hours and they're not going to, unless they want to pay me $45 an hour for 6 hours. And I don't even know if I'd probably have to charge more for that, just because it's not like something I could walk away from. I'm like actively, like, you know, changing voltages. And, you know, did it fail 15 minutes into it? Did it fail 3 hours into it? I'm going to have to come back and monitor it periodically. I would probably have to charge more for someone that wanted something that crazy.
So back in the day when you had your front side bus, you would normally have to match the RAM up to the CPU.
Yes.
Using the front side bus.
And, yeah.
But that's not necessarily the case anymore, correct?
Yeah, because, like, now you have more control over, like, the multipliers.
Okay.
But, yeah, when I first started overclocking, like, the AMD, this is why I had so much fun with the AMD. It was, like, each value affected everything. So the front side bus would affect the RAM speed, obviously, because it's all communicating through that base clock. And AMD called it something else. But you would need to make sure your RAM, if you're going to overclock through the base clock, even today, you need to make sure your RAM can handle that frequency increase. So that, I mean, you got some wiggle room with multipliers in the RAM, but there's also ideal optimal ratios. It gets really complicated, and I haven't spent a lot of time with memory overclocks. Just because the gains aren't there. Like, I mean, it's all about the CPU. Unless you're doing some weird server kind of workload, like databases, I've heard those kind of benefit from memory frequency overclocks. But, man, like, generally, like, you don't really need more than 2400 megahertz. I'd rather have 2400 megahertz with tight timings than 3000 megahertz with loose timings.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, I've done so many benchmark tests over the years when it comes to RAM, and to be honest with you, other than a benchmark in the real world, I never saw any increase from actually overclocking the RAM. Now, that's just personally myself, gaming or whatever. And even nowadays, I look at the modern games that we're playing, and basically, I look at it in Task Manager, and I go, if it reaches 8 gigs of RAM that I'm using, that's pretty high. I know, and I know some of the newer games are starting to access a little more. I just haven't seen it. And I carry 32 gigs in my system, but it's kind of like, why? Because I can, and it wasn't that much more to double it from 16 to 32.
Yeah. So talking about that, like, honestly, technically for a gaming system today, I mean, yeah, 8 gigs is kind of enough. Like, my new system has 32 gigs of RAM, and man, whether it's Battlefield 1, that, or, you know, Forza actually probably uses the most RAM, actually. I think Forza Horizon 3 uses more than Battlefield 1, but I don't think I've seen over 8 gigs of use, unless I'm streaming a game. And even then, the max I've seen was about 12, 13 gigs.
Right.
While streaming to Twitch. So I'm like, I got 32 gigs just because my system's an ITX build, and I only have 2 RAM slots. So I'm like, I'm just going to max it out. Like you said, it wasn't that expensive at the time. Although we're kind of seeing those prices go up right now.
Yeah.
But this is something, like, this is what a customer gets when they come to me, is I kind of, like, I feel it's my job to know all of this. And something that a lot of people aren't realizing, these video cards are getting so powerful that the frames per second people are getting on a 1080p monitor actually starts introducing some bottlenecks.
Right.
And Gamers Nexus on YouTube actually did Battlefield 1 testing with a GTX 1080 on 1080p, and 2400 megahertz RAM was 10 frames per second lower than 3000 megahertz RAM on 1080p.
Wow. But okay.
Once they switched it to 1440p and higher, that completely, like, disappeared. So I feel like you can't just throw the most expensive video card. If you're only going to be on 1080p, you don't need a 1080. You can maybe get a 1070 or a 1060. It's about kind of helping the customer realize what they want with their expectation they imagine, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that. I was able to, I think it was last year around this time, my 2 youngest boys built their own computers, and they were $600 builds. Went with a Core i5. I think they've got, we got 8 gigs of RAM, and then from 2 old systems I had, I was able to add, it was the same type of RAM, so we got them up to 12 gigs of RAM. Not a big deal there, but got them a R280, I think it was.
Okay.
$200 card, and they're playing on 24-inch monitors, 1080p, and they can run everything as high graphics as they want on that 1080p, and these systems just run, and they only cost $600.
Yeah.
You know, so for them, it was perfect. Now, you know, for me, I tend to, you know, I play in 2K, so I tend to bump up the graphics card a little bit just to make sure that I've got enough headroom where I can actually turn the graphics up.
Yeah, and I'm still on 1080p, but I love, like, frames per second. So I finally got this GTX 1080, and I'm like, oh man, I think this is even too much for 1080p. I think I need to go up to 1440 now, because it's just ridiculous. Like, Battlefield 1 Ultra settings will be like at 170 frames per second. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I have a 120 hertz monitor, so now I'm thinking, like, man, not even 144 would really utilize that. I mean, yeah, but no. And so now I'm thinking, like, all right, Black Friday, maybe I'll watch out for 1440p monitors. But there's a whole group of people that actually want as high as possible frames per second. They're selling 200 hertz monitors nowadays. So for that kind of customer, you kind of got to realize, like, they're going to need faster RAM. They're going to need more than an i5 just because, you know, it's totally taxing the CPU differently when you're talking about these astronomical numbers. So it's kind of, it's a crazy mixture of parts, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think we have covered everything from your builds and your process and how you do things. It's been a phenomenal amount of information. I really appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today. If people wanted to find out more about your custom builds and more about you, where would you send them?
I really enjoy using Instagram. So I would direct them there as like, you know, find me there. It's RemisCS, RemisCS. And then also my webpage, RemisCS.com. They could see some high resolution images of my builds and they could send me an email. There's a contact me page there. And also through my webpage, they could find my YouTube, my Twitter, and all of that. I guess I want to end with that. Like on Instagram, I get questioned a lot. Like, I really like what you're doing. How do I do this? You know, it seems like a lot of high school kids really, they're the ones that reach out to me. I want to do that. How do I do that? I always tell people customer service is number one.
Yes.
Because they could get a computer from anybody else. So customer service and know your product. Like, you know, don't guess. Like, look for benchmarks. I mean, I can't even afford to own every part to run my own benchmarks, but I try to like study benchmarks as much as possible. And by now I have like a nice set of, you know, I have experience behind me now, but this changes every 6 months, you know, like.
Oh yeah. It's hard to keep up unless you're constantly looking at that stuff.
Yeah. But customer service is number one, you know, caring about the customer. And, other than that, shoot me any questions you have. I'd be happy to answer them.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today.
Cool. Thanks, Jeff.
You guys can find me on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Hellish or Twitter at TechNutPC. If you'd like to be a guest, send an email to guest@podnuts.com. I want to thank our sponsor, Instant House Call, for this episode of Podnuts Daily. Don't forget, if you need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the TechNibble Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. You too can help support the Podnuts Network. The next time you're shopping at Amazon, go to podnuts.com/Amazon. Especially during this holiday season, this really helps out the network to be able to pay the bills to bring you these great shows. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.